As they ran down the dizzily steep steps, Alfred was gaining on Jack. They were still more than 12 feet off the ground when Jack realized Alfred was very nearly on him. In desperation, he jumped off the side of the wall onto the thatched roof of the carpenter's lodge. He bounced off the roof onto the ground, but he landed badly, twisting his ankle, and fell to the ground. He staggered upright. The seconds he lost by falling had enabled Alfred to reach the ground and run to the lodge. For a split second, Jack stood with his back to the wall, and Alfred paused, waiting to see which way he would jump. Jack suffered a moment of terrified indecision. Then, inspired, he stepped to one side and backed into the lodge. It was empty of craftsmen, for they were all standing around Enid's barrel. On the benches were the hammers and saws and chisels of the carpenters, and the pieces of wood they had been working on. In the middle of the floor was a large piece of new falsework, to be used in building an arch, and at the back, up against the church wall, was a blazing fire, fed by shavings and offcuts from the carpenter's raw material. There was no way out. Jack turned to face Alfred. He was cornered. For a moment he was paralyzed with fright. Then his fear gave way to anger. "I don't care if I get killed," he thought, "so long as I make Alfred bleed before I die." He did not wait for Alfred to hit him. He lowered his head and charged. He was too maddened even to use his fists. He simply ran into Alfred full tilt. It was the last thing Alfred expected. Jack's forehead smashed into his mouth. Jack was 2 or 3 inches shorter and a lot lighter, but all the same his charge threw Alfred back. As Jack recovered his balance, he saw blood on Alfred's lips, and he was satisfied. For a moment, Alfred was too surprised to react. In that instant, Jack's eye lit on a big wooden sledgehammer leaning against a bench. As Alfred recovered his wits and came at Jack, Jack lifted the hammer and swung it wildly. Alfred dodged back, and the hammer missed him. Suddenly, Jack had the upper hand. Encouraged, he went after Alfred, already relishing the sensation of solid wood crunching Alfred's bones. This time he put all his strength into the blow. Once again it missed Alfred, but it connected with the pole supporting the roof of the lodge. The lodge was not solidly constructed. Nobody lived in it. Its only function was to enable the carpenters to work in the rain. When Jack hit the pole with the hammer, the pole moved. The walls were flimsy hurdles of interwoven twigs and gave no support at all. The thatched roof sagged. Alfred looked up fearfully. Jack hefted the hammer. Alfred backed through the door. Jack swung at him again. Alfred dodged back, tripped over a low stack of timber, and sat down heavily. Jack raised the hammer high for the coup de grace. His arms were raised in a strong grasp. He looked around and saw Prior Philip with a face like thunder. Philip wrenched the hammer from Jack's grip. Behind the prior, the roof of the lodge fell in. Jack and Philip looked. As it fell into the fire, the dry thatch caught alight instantly, and a moment later there was a fierce blaze. Tom appeared and pointed at the three workmen nearest to him. "You, you, and you, bring that water butt from outside the smithy." He turned to three others. "Peter, Rolf, Daniel, fetch buckets. You apprentices shovel earth over the flames, all of you, and quick about it." For the next few minutes, everyone concentrated on the fire, and Alfred and Jack were forgotten. Jack got out of the way and stood watching, feeling stunned and helpless. Alfred stood some distance away. "Was I really about to smash Alfred's head with a hammer?" Jack thought incredulously. The whole thing seemed unreal. He was still in a state of dazed shock when the combination of water and earth put out the flames. Prior Philip stood looking at the mess, breathing hard after his exertions. "Look at that," he said to Tom. He was furious. "A lodge wrecked, carpenter's work ruined, a barrel of lime wasted, and a whole section of new masonry destroyed." Jack realized that Tom was in trouble. It was his job to keep order on the site, and Philip blamed him for the damage. The fact that the culprits were Tom's sons made it even worse. Tom put his hand on Philip's arm and spoke softly. "The lodge will deal with it," he said. Philip was not to be mollified. "I will deal with it," he snapped. "I'm the prior, and you all work for me."
"Then allow the masons to deliberate before you make any decisions," Tom said in a quiet and reasonable voice. "We may come up with a proposal that will recommend itself to you. If not, you're still free to do what you will."
Philip was visibly reluctant to let the initiative pass from his hands, but tradition was on Tom's side. The Masons disciplined themselves. After a pause, Philip said,
"Very well, but whatever you decide, I will not have both your sons working on this site. One of them must go."
Still fuming, he strode away. With a black look at Jack and Alfred, Tom turned away and went into the largest of the Masons' lodges. Jack realized he was in serious trouble as he followed Tom into the lodge. When the Masons disciplined one of their number, it was usually for offenses such as drunkenness at work and theft of building materials, and the commonest punishment was a fine. Fighting between apprentices generally resulted in both combatants being put in the stocks for a day. But of course Alfred was not an apprentice, and anyway, fights did not normally do so much damage. The lodge could expel a member who worked for less than the agreed minimum wage. It could also punish a member who committed adultery with another Mason's wife, although Jack had never known this. Theoretically, apprentices could be flogged, but although this punishment was sometimes threatened, he had never seen it carried out. The Master Masons crowded into the wooden lodge, sitting on the benches and leaning against the back wall, which was in fact the side of the cathedral. When they were all inside, Tom said,
"Our employer is angry, and with justification. This incident has done a lot of costly damage. Worse, it has brought disgrace on us Masons. We must deal firmly with those who are to blame. This is the only way to regain our good reputation as proud and disciplined builders, men who are masters of ourselves as well as masters of our craft."
"Well said," Jack Blacksmith called out, and there was a murmur of agreement.
"I only saw the end of this fight," Tom went on. "Did anyone see it start?"
"Alfred went for the lad," said Peter Carpenter, the one who had advised Jack to be obedient and fetch Alfred's ale. A young mason called Dan, who worked for Alfred, said,
"Jack threw beer in Alfred's face."
"The lad was provoked, though," said Peter. "Alfred insulted Jack's natural father."
Tom looked at Alfred.
"Did you?"
"I said his father was a thief," Alfred replied. "It's true. He was hanged for it at Sharing. Sheriff Eustace told me yesterday."
Jack Blacksmith said,
"It's a poor thing if a master craftsman has to hold his tongue in case an apprentice doesn't like what he says."
There was a murmur of approval. Jack realized despondently that whatever happened, he was not going to get off lightly. "Perhaps I'm doomed to be a criminal, like my father," he thought. "Perhaps I'll end up on the gallows, too."
Peter Carpenter, who was emerging as Jack's defender, said, "I still say it makes a difference if the craftsman went out of his way to anger the apprentice."
"The apprentice still has to be punished," said Jack Blacksmith.
"I don't deny that," said Peter. "I just think the craftsman ought to be disciplined, too. Master craftsmen should use the wisdom of their years to bring about peace and harmony on a building site. If they provoke fights, they fail in their duty."
There appeared to be some agreement with that, but Dan, Alfred's supporter, said,
"It's a dangerous principle to forgive the apprentice because the craftsman was unkind. Apprentices always think masters are unkind. If you start arguing that way, you'll end up with masters never speaking to their apprentices, for fear the apprentices will strike them for discourtesy."
That speech drew warm support to Jack's disgust. It just showed that the master's authority had to be bolstered, regardless of the rights and wrongs of the case. He wondered what his punishment would be. He had no money to pay a fine. He hated the thought of being put in the stocks. What would Aliena think of him? But it would be worse to be flogged. He thought he would knife anyone who tried to flog him.
Tom said, "We mustn't forget that our employer also has a strong view about this. He says he will not have both Alfred and Jack working on the site. One of them must go."
"Might he be talked out of that?" said Peter.
Tom looked thoughtful, but after a pause he said,
"No."
Jack was shocked. He had not taken Prior Philip's ultimatum seriously, but Tom had.
Dan said, "If one of them has to go, I trust there's no argument about which it will be."
Dan was one of the Masons working for Alfred, rather than directly for the Priory, and if Alfred went, Dan would probably have to go too. Once again Tom looked thoughtful, and once again he said, "No. No argument." He looked at Jack. Jack must be the one to go. Jack realized he had fatally underestimated the consequences of the fight, but he could hardly believe they were going to throw him out. What would life be like if he did not work on Kingsbridge Cathedral? Since Aliena had withdrawn into her shell, the cathedral was all he cared about. How could he leave? Peter Carpenter said, "The Priory might accept a compromise. Jack could be suspended for a month." "Yes, please," thought Jack. "Too weak," said Tom. "We must be seen to act decisively. Prior Philip will not accept anything less." "So be it," Peter said, giving in. "This cathedral loses the most talented young stone carver most of us have ever seen, all because Alfred can't keep his damn mouth shut." Several masons voiced their approval of that sentiment. Encouraged, Peter went on, "I respect you, Tom Builder, more than I've ever respected any master builder I've worked for. But it must be said that you've got a blind spot about your pig-headed son, Alfred." "No abuse, please," Tom said. "Let's stick to the facts of the case." "All right," Peter said. "I say Alfred must be punished." "I agree," Tom said, to everyone's surprise. Jack thought the remark about his blind spot had got to him. "Alfred should be disciplined."
"Why?"
Alfred said indignantly.
"For beating an apprentice."
"He's not your apprentice, he's mine," Tom said. "And you did more than beat him, you chased him all over the site. If you had let him run away, the lime wouldn't have spilled, the masonry wouldn't have been damaged, and the carpenter's lodge wouldn't have burnt down. And you could have dealt with him as soon as he came back. There was no need for what you did." The masons agreed. Dan, who seemed to have become the spokesman for Alfred's mason, said, "I hope you're not proposing we expel Alfred from the lodge. I, for one, will fight against that." "No," Tom said. "It's bad enough to lose a talented apprentice. I don't also want to lose a sound mason who runs a reliable gang. Alfred must stay, but I think he should be fined." Alfred's men looked relieved.
"A heavy fine," said Peter. "A week's wages," Dan proposed.
"A month's," said Tom. "I doubt whether Prior Philip will be satisfied with less." Several men said,
"Are we of one mind on this, Brother Masons?" Tom said, using a customary form of words.
"Aye," they all said.
"Then I will tell the prior our decision.
The rest of you had better go back to work." Jack watched miserably as they all filed out. Alfred shot him a look of smug triumph. Tom waited until they had all gone, then said to Jack, "I did my best for you. I hope your mother will see that."
"You've never done anything for me," Jack burst out. "You couldn't feed me or clothe me or house me. We were happy until you came along, and then we starved.
But in the end, you won't even protect me from that mindless brute you call your son."
"I tried. You wouldn't even have this job if I hadn't burned the old cathedral down."
"What did you say?"
"Yes,
I burned the old cathedral."
Tom went pale.
"That was lightning."
"There was no lightning. It was a fine night, and no one had made a fire in the church either. I set light to the roof."
"But why?"
"So that you would have work. Otherwise my mother would have died in the forest."
"She wouldn't. Your first wife did, though, didn't she?"
Tom turned white. Suddenly he looked older. Jack realized that he had wounded Tom profoundly. He had won the argument, but he had probably lost a friend. He felt sour and sad. Tom whispered, "Get out of here." Jack left. He walked away from the towering walls of the cathedral, close to tears. His life had been devastated in a few moments. It was incredible that he was going away from this church forever. He turned at the priory gate and looked back. There were so many things he had been planning. He wanted to carve a whole doorway all by himself. He wanted to persuade Tom to have stone angels in the clerestory. He had an innovative design for blind arcading in the transepts, which he had not even shown to anyone yet. Now he would never do any of these things. It was so unfair. His eyes filled with tears. He made his way home, seeing through a blur. Mother and Martha were sitting at the kitchen table. Mother was teaching Martha to write with a sharp stone and a slate. They were surprised to see him. Martha said, "It can't be dinner time already." Mother read Jack's face. "What is it?" she said anxiously. "I had a fight with Alfred and got expelled from the site," he said grimly.
"Wasn't Alfred expelled?" said Martha.
Jack shook his head.
"That's not fair," Martha said.
Mother said wearily, "What did you fight about this time?" Jack said, "Was my father hanged at Shiring for thieving?" Martha gasped. Mother looked sad.
"He wasn't a thief," she said.
"But yes, he was hanged at Shiring." Jack was fed up with enigmatic statements about his father. He said brutally, "Why will you never tell me the truth?"
"Because it makes me so sad," Mother burst out, and to Jack's horror she began to cry.
He had never seen her cry. She was always so strong. He was close to breaking down himself. He swallowed hard and persisted.
"If he wasn't a thief, why was he hanged?"
"I don't know," Mother cried. "I never knew. He never knew either. They said he stole a jeweled cup."
"From whom?"
"From here. From Kingsbridge Priory."
"Kingsbridge? Did Prior Philip accuse him?"
"No, no, it was long before the time of Philip."
She looked at Jack through her tears.
"Don't start asking me who accused him and why. Don't get caught in that trap. You could spend the rest of your life trying to put right a wrong done before you were born. I didn't raise you so that you could take revenge. Don't make that your life."
Jack vowed he would learn more sometime, despite what she said. But right now he wanted her to stop crying. He sat beside her on the bench and put his arm around her.
"Well, it looks as if the cathedral won't be my life now."
Martha said, "What will you do, Jack?"
"I don't know. I can't live in Kingsbridge, can I?"
Martha was distraught.
"But why not?"
"Alfred tried to kill me and Tom expelled me from the site. I'm not going to live with them. Anyway, I'm a man. I should leave my mother."
"But what will you do?"
Jack shrugged. "The only thing I know about is building."
"You could work on another church."
"I might come to love another cathedral as much as I love this one, I suppose," he said despondently. He was thinking, "But I'll never love another woman the way I love Aliena." Mother said, "How could Tom do this to you?"
Jack sighed. "I don't think he really wanted to. Prior Philip said he wouldn't have me and Alfred both working on the site."
"So that damned monk is at the bottom of this," Mother said angrily.
"I swear,
he was very upset about the damage we did."
"I wonder if he could be made to see reason."
"What do you mean?"
"God is supposed to be merciful. Perhaps monks should be too."
"You think I should plead with Philip?" Jack asked, somewhat surprised at the direction of Mother's thinking.
"I was thinking I might talk to him," she said.
"You?"
That was even more uncharacteristic. Jack was quite shocked. For Mother to be willing to ask Philip for mercy, she must be badly upset.
"What do you think?" she asked him.
Tom had seemed to think Philip would not be merciful, Jack recalled. But then Tom's overriding concern had been that the Lodge should take decisive action. Having promised Philip that they would be firm, Tom could not then plead for mercy. Mother was not in the same position. Jack began to feel a little more hopeful. Perhaps he would not have to leave after all. Perhaps he could stay in Kingsbridge, close to the cathedral and to Aliena. He no longer hoped that she would love him, but nevertheless he hated the thought of going away and never seeing her again.
"All right," he said. "Let's go and plead with Prior Philip. We've got nothing to lose but our pride."
Mother put on her cloak and they went out together, leaving Martha sitting alone at the table, looking anxious. Jack and his mother did not often walk side by side, and now he was struck by how short she was. He towered over her. He felt suddenly fond of her. She was always ready to fight like a cat for his sake. He put his arm around her and hugged her. She smiled at him as if she knew what he was thinking. They entered the priory close and went to the prior's house. Mother banged on the door and walked in. Tom was there with Prior Philip. Jack knew immediately by their faces that Tom had not told Philip about Jack setting fire to the old cathedral. That was a relief. Now he probably never would. That secret was safe. Tom looked anxious, if not a little scared, when he saw Mother. Jack recalled that he had said, "I did my best for you. I hope your mother will see that." Tom was remembering the last time Jack and Alfred had a fight. Mother had left Tom in consequence. Tom was afraid she would leave now. Philip was no longer looking angry, Jack thought. Perhaps the lodge's decision had mollified him. He might even be feeling a trifle guilty about his harshness. Mother said, "I've come here to ask you to be merciful, Prior Philip." Tom immediately looked relieved. Philip said, "I'm listening." Mother said, "You're proposing to send my son away from everything he loves, his home, his family, and his work." "And the woman he adores," Jack thought. Philip said, "Am I? I thought he had simply been dismissed from his work. He's never learned any kind of work but building, and there's no other building work in Kingsbridge for him. And the challenge of that vast church has got into his blood. He'll go wherever someone is building a cathedral. He'll go to Jerusalem if the stone there to be carved into angels and devils." How does she know all this? Jack wondered. He had hardly thought it himself, but it was true. She added, "I might never see him again." Her voice shook a little at the end, and he thought wonderingly how much she must love him. She would never plead like this for herself, he knew. Philip looked sympathetic, but it was Tom who replied. "We can't have Jack and Alfred working on the same site," he said doggedly. "They'll fight again. You know that."
"Alfred could go," Mother said.
Tom looked sad. "Alfred is my son."
"But he's 20 years old, and he's mean as a bear."
Although Mother's voice was assertive, her cheeks were wet with tears. "He doesn't care for this cathedral any more than I do. He'd be perfectly happy building houses for butchers and bakers in Winchester or Shiring." "The lodge can't expel Alfred and keep Jack," Tom said. "Besides, the decision is already made."
"But it's the wrong decision,"
Philip spoke.
"There might be another answer."
Everyone looked at him. There might be a way for Jack to stay in Kingsbridge and even devote himself to the cathedral without falling foul of Alfred. Jack wondered what was coming. This sounded too good to be true.
"I need someone to work with me," Philip went on. "I spend too much time making detailed decisions on the building. I need a kind of assistant who would fulfill the role of clerk of works. He would deal with most of the queries himself, referring only the most important questions to me. He would also keep track of the money and the raw materials, handling payments to suppliers and carters, and wages, too. Jack can read and write, and he can add numbers faster than anyone I've ever met. And he understands every aspect of building," Tom put in. "I've seen to that." Jack's mind was spinning. He could stay after all. He would be clerk of works. He would not be carving stone, but he would be supervising the entire design on Philip's behalf. It was an astonishing proposal. He would have to deal with Tom as an equal, but he knew he was capable of it. And Tom did, too. There was one snag. Jack voiced it. "I can't live with Alfred any longer." Ellen said, "It's time Alfred had a home of his own, anyway. Perhaps if he left us, he'd be more serious about finding a wife." Tom said angrily, "You keep thinking of reasons for getting rid of Alfred. I'm not going to throw my own son out of my house." "You don't understand me, either of you," Philip said. "You haven't completely comprehended my proposal. Jack would not be living with you."
He paused. Jack guessed what was coming next, and it was the last and biggest shock of the day. Philip said, "Jack would have to live here, in the priory." He looked at them with a little frown, as if he could not see why they still had not grasped his meaning. Jack had understood him. He recalled Mother saying on Midsummer Eve last year, "That sly prior has a knack of getting his own way in the end." She had been right. Philip was renewing the offer he had made then, but this time it was different. The choice Jack now faced was stark. He could leave Kingsbridge and abandon everything he loved, or he could stay and lose his freedom. "My clerk of works can't be a layman, of course," Philip finished.
in the tone of one who states the obvious. Jack will have to become a monk. 5. On the night before the Kingsbridge Fleece Fair, Prior Philip stayed up after the midnight services as usual, but instead of reading and meditating in his house, he made a tour of the Priory Close. It was a warm summer night with a clear sky and a moon, and he could see without the aid of a lantern. The entire close had been taken over by the fair, with the exception of the monastic buildings and the cloisters, which were sacred. In each of the four corners, a huge latrine pit had been dug, so that the rest of the close would not become completely foul, and the latrines had been screened off to safeguard the sensibilities of the monks. Literally hundreds of market stalls had been erected. The simplest were nothing more than crude wooden counters on trestles. Most were a little more elaborate. They had a signboard with the name of the stallholder and a picture of his wares, a separate table for weighing, and a locked cupboard or shed to keep the goods in. Some stalls incorporated tents, either to keep the rain off or so that business could be done in private. The most elaborate stalls were small houses, with large storage areas, several counters, and tables and chairs where the merchant could offer hospitality to his important customers. Philip had been surprised when the first of the merchant's carpenters had arrived a full week before the fair, and demanded to be shown where to erect his stall, but the structure that went up had taken 4 days to build and 2 to stock. Philip had originally planned the layout of the stalls in 2 wide avenues on the west side of the close, in much the same configuration as the stalls of the weekly market, but he had soon realized that that would not be enough. The 2 avenues of stalls now ran all along the north side of the church as well, and then turned down the east end of the close as far as Philip's house, and there were more stalls actually inside the unfinished church, in the aisles between the piers. The stallholders were not all wool merchants by any means. Everything was sold at a fair, from horsebread to rubies. Philip walked along the moonlit rows. They were all ready now, of course. No stall building would be allowed today. Most of them were also stocked with goods. The priory had already collected more than £10 in fees and duties. The only goods that could be brought in on the day of the fair were freshly cooked foods, bread and hot pies and baked apples. Even the barrels of beer had been brought in yesterday. As Philip walked around, he was watched by dozens of half-open eyes, and greeted by several sleepy grunts. The stallholders would not leave their precious goods unguarded. Most of them were sleeping at their stalls, and the wealthier merchants had left servants on guard. He was not yet certain exactly how much money he would make from the fair, but it was virtually guaranteed to be a success, and he was confident of reaching his original estimate of £50. There had been moments in the past few months when he had feared that the fair would not take place at all. The Civil War dragged on, with neither Stephen nor Maud gaining the upper hand, but his license had not been revoked. William Hamley had tried to sabotage the fair in various ways. He had told the sheriff to ban it, but the sheriff had asked for authority from one of the 2 rival monarchs, and it had not been forthcoming. William had forbidden his tenants to sell wool at Kingsbridge, but most of them were anyway in the habit of selling to merchants, such as Aliena, rather than marketing the fleeces themselves, so the main effect of the ban was to create more business for her. Finally, he had announced that he was reducing the rents and duties at the Shiring Fleece Fair to the levels Philip was charging, but his announcement came too late to make much difference, for the big buyers and sellers had already made their plans. Now, with the sky growing perceptibly lighter in the east on the morning of the big day, William could do no more. The sellers were here with their wares, and in a little while the buyers would begin to arrive. Philip thought William would find that in the end the Kingsbridge Fleece Fair damaged the Shiring Fair less than he feared. Sales of wool seemed to go up every year without fail. There was enough business for 2 fairs anyway. He had walked all the way around the close to the southwest corner, where the mills and the fish pond were. He stood there for a while, watching the water flow past the 2 silent mills. One was now used exclusively for felting cloth, and it made a lot of money. Young Jack was responsible for that. He had an ingenious mind. He was going to be a tremendous asset to the priory.
He seemed to have settled quite well as a novice, although he tended to regard the services as a distraction from cathedral building, rather than the other way around. However, he would learn. The monastic life was a sanctifying influence. Philip thought God had a purpose for Jack. In the very back of Philip's mind was a secret long-term hope that one day Jack would take his place as prior of Kingsbridge. Jack got up at dawn and slipped out of the dormitory before the service of prime to make one last inspection tour of the building site. The morning air was cool and clear like pure water from a spring. It would be a warm, sunny day, good for business, good for the priory. He walked around the cathedral walls, making sure that all the tools and work in progress were safely locked inside the lodges. Tom had built light wooden fences around the stockpiles of timber and stone to guard the raw materials against accidental damage by careless or drunken visitors. They did not want any daredevils climbing the structure, so all the ladders were safely hidden away. The spiral staircases in the thickness of the walls were closed off with temporary doors, and the stepped ends of the part-built walls were obstructed by wooden blocks. Some of the master craftsmen would be patrolling the site throughout the day to make sure there was no damage. Jack managed to skip quite a lot of the services, one way or another. There was always something to be done on site. He did not have his mother's hatred of the Christian religion, but he was more or less indifferent to it. He had no enthusiasm for it, but he was willing to go through the motions if it suited his purpose. He made sure to go to one service every day, usually one that was attended either by Prior Philip or the novice master, who were the two senior monks most likely to notice his presence or absence. He could not have borne it if he had to attend them all. Being a monk was the strangest and most perverted way of life imaginable. Monks spent half their lives putting themselves through pain and discomfort that they could easily avoid, and the other half muttering meaningless mumbo-jumbo in empty churches at all hours of the day and night. They deliberately shunned anything good, girls, sports, feasting, and family life. However, Jack had noted, the happiest among them had usually found some pursuit that gave deep satisfaction, illustrating manuscripts, writing history, cooking, studying philosophy, or, like Philip, changing Kingsbridge from a sleepy village into a thriving cathedral city. Jack did not like Philip, but he liked working with him. Jack did not warm to professional men of God any more than his mother did. He was embarrassed by Philip's piety. He disliked his single-minded sinlessness, and he mistrusted his tendency to believe that God would take care of anything that he, Philip, could not cope with. Nevertheless, Philip was good to work for. His orders were clear. He left Jack room to make decisions for himself, and he never blamed his servants for his own mistakes. Jack had been a novice only 3 months, so he would not be asked to take vows for another 9 months. The three vows were poverty, celibacy, and obedience. The vow of poverty was not all it seemed. Monks had no personal possessions and no money of their own, but they lived more like lords than like peasants. They had good food, warm clothes, and fine stone buildings to live in. Celibacy was no problem, Jack thought bitterly. He had gained a certain cold satisfaction from telling Aliena personally that he was entering the monastery. She had looked shocked and guilty. Now, whenever he felt the restless irritability that came from the lack of female companionship, he would think of how Aliena had treated him, their secret assignations in the forest, their winter evenings, the 2 times he had kissed her, and then he would recall how she had suddenly turned as cold and hard as a rock. And thinking of that made him feel that he never wanted to have anything more to do with women. However, the vow of obedience would be difficult to keep, he could tell already. He was happy to take orders from Philip, who was intelligent and organized, but it was hard to obey the foolish sub-prior, Remigius, or the drunken guest-master, or the pompous sacrist. Nevertheless, he was contemplating taking the vows. He did not have to keep them. All he cared about was building the cathedral. The problems of supply, construction, and management were endlessly absorbing. One day he might have to help Tom devise a method of checking that the number of stones arriving at the site was the same as the number leaving the quarry. A complex problem, for the journey time varied between 2 days and 4,
so it was not possible to have a simple daily tally. Another day the masons might complain that the carpenters were not making the false work properly. Most challenging of all were the engineering problems, such as how to lift tons of stone to the top of the walls using makeshift machinery fixed to flimsy scaffolding. Tom Builder discussed these problems with Jack as with an equal. He seemed to have forgiven Jack for that angry speech, in which Jack said that Tom had never done anything for him. And Tom acted as if he had forgotten the revelation that Jack had set fire to the old cathedral. They worked together cheerfully, and the days flew by. Even during the tedious services, Jack's mind was occupied by some knotty question of construction or planning. His knowledge was increasing fast. Instead of spending years carving stones, he was learning cathedral design. There could hardly have been a better training for someone who wanted to be a master builder. For that, Jack was prepared to yawn through any number of midnight matins. The sun was edging over the east wall of the priory close. Everything was in order on the site. The stallholders, who had spent the night with their goods, were beginning to fold away their bedding and put out their wares. Their first customers would be here soon. A baker walked past Jack carrying a tray of new loaves on her head. The smell of hot fresh bread made Jack's mouth water. He turned back and went back to the monastery, heading for the refectory, where they would soon be serving breakfast. The first customers were the families of the stallholders and the townspeople, all curious to look at the first Kingsbridge Fleece Fair, none very interested in buying. Thrifty people had filled their bellies with horse bread and porridge before leaving home, so that they would not be tempted by the highly spiced and garishly coloured confections on the food stalls. The children wandered around wide-eyed, dazzled by the display of desirable things. An optimistic early-rising whore with red lips and red boots sauntered along, smiling hopefully at middle-aged men, but there were no takers at this hour. Aliena watched it all from her stall, which was one of the biggest. In the last few weeks she had taken delivery of Kingsbridge Priory's entire output of fleece for the year, the wool for which she had paid £107 last summer. She had also been buying from farmers, as she always did, and this year there had been more sellers than usual, because William Hamley had forbidden his tenants to sell at the Kingsbridge Fair, so they had all sold to merchants. And of all the merchants, Aliena had got the most business, because she was based at Kingsbridge, where the fair was to be held. She had done so well that she had run out of money for buying, and had borrowed £40 from Malachi to keep her going. Now, in the warehouse that formed the rear half of her stall, she had 160 sacks of raw wool, the product of 40,000 sheep, and it had cost her more than £200, but she would sell it for £300, which was enough money to pay the wages of a skilled mason for over a century. The sheer scale of her own business amazed her whenever she thought of the numbers. She did not expect to see her buyers until midday. There would be only 5 or 6 of them. They would all know each other, and she would know most of them from previous years. She would give each one a cup of wine and sit and talk for a while. Then she would show him her wool. He would ask her to open a sack or two, never the top one on the pile, of course. He would plunge his hand deep into the sack and bring out a handful of wool. He would tease out the strands to determine their length, rub them between finger and thumb to test their softness, and sniff them. Finally, he would offer to buy her entire stock at a ridiculously low price, and Aliena would refuse him. She would tell him her asking price, and he would shake his head. They would take another glass of wine. Aliena would go through the same ritual with another buyer. She would give dinner to as many of them as were there at midday. Someone would offer to take a large quantity of wool at a price not much above what Aliena had paid for it. She would counter by dropping her asking price a shade. In the early afternoon she would begin closing deals. Her first deal would be at a lowish price. The other merchants would demand that she deal with them at the same price, but she would refuse. Her price would go up during the course of the afternoon. If it went up too fast, business would be slow, while the merchants calculated how soon they could fill their quotas elsewhere. If she was asking less than they were willing to pay, she would know by the relative haste with which they reached agreement. She would close deals one by one, and their servants would begin loading the huge sacks of wool onto the ox wagons with their enormous wooden wheels,
while Aliena weighed the pound bags of silver pennies and guilders. There was no doubt that today she would rake in more money than ever before. She had twice as much to sell, and wool prices were up. She planned to buy Philip's output a year in advance again, and she had a secret scheme to build herself a stone house, with spacious cellars for storage of wool, an elegant and comfortable hall, and a pretty upstairs bedroom just for herself. Her future was secure, and she was confident of being able to support Richard as long as he needed her. Everything was perfect. That was why it was so strange that she was completely and utterly miserable.
It was 4 years, almost to the day, since Ellen had returned to Kingsbridge, and they had been the best 4 years of Tom's life. The pain of Agnes's death had dulled to an ache. It was still with him, but he no longer got that embarrassing feeling that he was about to burst into tears every now and again for no apparent reason. He still held imaginary conversations with her, in which he told her about the children and Prior Philip and the cathedral. But the conversations were less frequent. The bittersweet memory of her had not blighted his love for Ellen. He was able to live in the present. Seeing Ellen and touching her, talking to her and sleeping with her were daily joys. He had been deeply wounded on the day of the fight between Jack and Alfred by Jack saying that Tom had never looked after him, and that accusation had overshadowed even the appalling revelation that Jack had set fire to the old cathedral. He had agonized over it for several weeks, but in the end he had decided that Jack was wrong. Tom had done his best, and no man could do any more. Having reached that conclusion, he had stopped worrying. Building Kingsbridge Cathedral was the most profoundly satisfying work he had ever done. He was responsible for the design and the execution. No one interfered with him, and there was no one else to blame if things went wrong. As the mighty walls rose, with their rhythmic arches, their graceful mouldings, and their individual carvings, he could look around and think, "I did all this, and I did it well." His nightmare that one day he would again find himself on the road with no work, no money, and no way of feeding his children, seemed very far away, now that there was a stout money chest full to bursting with silver pennies buried under the straw in his kitchen. He still shuddered when he remembered that cold, cold night when Agnes had given birth to Jonathan and died, but he felt sure nothing that bad would ever happen again. He sometimes wondered why Ellen and he had not had children. They had both been proved fertile in the past, and there was no shortage of opportunities for her to get pregnant. They still made love almost every night, even after 4 years. However, it was not a cause of deep regret to him. Little Jonathan was the apple of his eye. He knew from past experience that the best way to enjoy a fair was with a small child. So he sought Jonathan out around mid-morning, when the crowds began to arrive. Jonathan was almost an attraction in his own right, dressed as he was in his miniature habit. He had lately conceived a desire to have his head shaved, and Philip had indulged him. Philip was as fond of the child as Tom was, with the result that he looked more than ever like a tiny little monk. There were several real midgets in the crowd, performing tricks and begging, and they fascinated Jonathan. Tom had to hurry him away from one who drew a crowd by exposing his full-size penis. There were jugglers, acrobats, and musicians performing and passing a hat round, soothsayers and surgeons and whores touting for business, trials of strength, wrestling contests, and games of chance. People were wearing their most colourful clothes, and those who could afford it had doused themselves with scent and oiled their hair. Everyone seemed to have money to spend, and the air was full of the jingle of silver. The bear baiting was about to begin. Jonathan had never seen a bear, and he was fascinated. The animal's greyish-brown coat was scarred in several places, indicating that it had survived at least one previous contest. A heavy chain around its waist was fixed to a stake driven deep into the ground, and it was padding around on all fours at the limit of the chain, glaring angrily at the waiting crowd. Tom fancied he saw a cunning light in the beast's eye. Had he been a gambling man, he might have bet on the bear. The sound of frantic barking came from a locked chest to one side. The dogs were in there, and they could smell their enemy. Every now and again the bear would stop his pacing, look at the box, and growl, and the barking would rise to hysteria pitch. The owner of the animals, the bear ward,
was taking bets. Jonathan became impatient, and Tom was about to move on, when at last the bear ward unlocked the box. The bear stood upright at the limit of its chain and snarled. The bear ward shouted something and threw the chest open. 5 greyhounds sprang out. They were light and fast-moving, and their gaping mouths showed sharp little teeth. They all went straight for the bear. The bear lashed out at them with its massive paws. It struck one dog and sent it flying. Then the others backed off. The crowd pushed closer. Tom checked on Jonathan. He was at the front, but still well out of the bear's reach. The bear was clever enough to draw back to the stake, letting its chain go loose, so that when it lunged, it would not be brought up short. But the dogs were smart, too. After their initial scattered attack, they regrouped, then spread out in a circle. The bear swung around in an agitated fashion, trying to see all ways at once. One of the dogs rushed at it, yapping fiercely. The bear came to meet it and lashed out. The dog quickly retreated, staying out of reach, and the other 4 rushed in from all sides. The bear swung around, swiping at them. The crowd cheered as 3 of them sank their teeth into the flesh of its haunches. It rose on its hind legs with a roar of pain, shaking them off, and they scrambled out of reach. The dogs tried the same tactic once more. Tom thought the bear was going to fall for it again. The first dog darted within its reach. The bear went for it, and the dog backed off. But when the other dogs rushed the bear, it was ready for them, and it turned quickly, lunged at the nearest, and swiped the dog's side with its paw. The crowd cheered as much for the bear as they had for the dogs. The bear's sharp claws ripped the dog's silky skin and left 3 deep, bloody tracks. The dog yelped pitifully and retired from the fight to lick its wounds. The crowd jeered and booed. The remaining 4 dogs circled the bear warily, making the occasional rush but turning back well before the danger point. Someone started a slow hand clap. Then a dog made a frontal attack. It rushed in like a streak of lightning, slipped under the bear's swipe, and leaped for its throat. The crowd went wild. The dog sank its pointed white teeth into the bear's massive neck. The other dogs attacked. The bear reared up, pawing at the dog at its throat, then went down and rolled. For a moment Tom could not tell what was happening. There was just a flurry of fur. Then 3 dogs jumped clear, and the bear righted itself and stood on all 4s, leaving 1 dog on the ground, crushed to death. The crowd became tense. The bear had eliminated 2 dogs, leaving 3, but it was bleeding from its back, neck, and hind legs, and it looked frightened. The air was full of the smell of blood and the sweat of the crowd. The dogs had stopped yapping and were circling the bear silently. They too looked scared, but they had the taste of blood in their mouths, and they wanted a kill. Their attack began the same way. One of them rushed in and rushed out again. The bear swiped at it half-heartedly and swung around to meet the second dog. But now this one too cut short its rush and retreated out of reach. And then the 3rd dog did the same. The dogs darted in and out one at a time, keeping the bear constantly shifting and turning. With each rush they got a little closer, and the bear's claws came a little nearer to catching them. The spectators could see what was happening, and the excitement in the crowd grew. Jonathan was still at the front, just a few steps from Tom, looking awestruck and a little frightened. Tom looked back at the fight just in time to see the bear's claws brush one dog while another dashed between the great beast's hind legs and savaged its soft belly. The bear made a sound like a scream. The dog dashed out from under it and escaped. Another dog rushed the bear. The bear slashed at it, missing by inches. And then the same dog went for its underbelly again. This time, when the dog escaped, it left the bear with a huge, bleeding gash in its abdomen. The bear reared up and went down on all 4s again. For a moment, Tom thought it was finished, but he was wrong. The bear still had some fight left in it. When the next dog rushed in, the bear made a token swipe at it, turned its head, saw the second dog coming, turned surprisingly fast, and hit it with a mighty blow that sent it flying through the air. The crowd roared with delight. The dog landed like a bag of meat. Tom watched it for a moment. It was alive, but it seemed unable to move. Perhaps its back was broken. The bear ignored it, for it was out of reach and out of action. Now there were only 2 dogs left. They both darted in and out of the bear's reach several times, until its lunges at them became perfunctory.
Then they began to circle it, moving faster and faster. The bear turned this way and that, trying to keep them both in sight. Exhausted and bleeding copiously, it could hardly stay upright. The dogs went around in ever-decreasing circles. The earth beneath the bear's mighty paws had been turned to mud by all the blood. One way or another, the end was in sight. Finally, the two dogs attacked at once. One went for the throat, and the other for the belly. With a last desperate swipe, the bear slashed the dog at its throat. There was a grisly fountain of blood. The crowd yelled their approval. At first, Tom thought the dog had killed the bear, but it was the other way around. The blood came from the dog, which now fell to the ground with its throat slashed open. Its blood pumped out for a moment longer, then stopped. It was dead. But in the meantime, the last dog had ripped open the bear's belly, and now its guts were falling out. The bear swiped feebly at the dog. The dog easily evaded the blow and struck again, savaging the bear's intestines. The bear swayed and seemed about to fall. The roar of the crowd grew to a crescendo. The bear's ripped guts gave out a revolting stench. It gathered its strength and struck at the dog again. The blow connected, and the dog jumped sideways with blood oozing from a slash along its back. But the wound was superficial, and the dog knew the bear was finished. So it went right back on the attack, biting at the bear's guts until at last the great animal closed its eyes and slumped to the ground, dead. The bear ward came forward and took the victorious dog by the collar. The Kingsbridge butcher and his apprentice stepped out of the crowd and began to cut the bear up for its meat. Tom supposed they had agreed on a price with the bear ward in advance. Those who had won their bets demanded to be paid. Everyone wanted to pat the surviving dog. Tom looked for Jonathan. He could not see him. The child had been just a couple of yards away throughout the bear baiting. How had he managed to disappear? It must have happened while the sport was at its height and Tom was concentrating on the spectacle. Now he was cross with himself. He searched the crowd. Tom was a head taller than everyone else, and Jonathan was easy to spot with his monk's habit and shaved head, but he was nowhere to be seen. The child could not come to much harm in the priory close, but he might come across things that Prior Philip would prefer him not to see. Whores servicing their clients up against the priory wall, for example. Looking around, Tom glanced up at the scaffolding high on the cathedral building, and there, to his horror, he saw a small figure in a monastic robe. He felt a moment of panic. He wanted to yell, "Don't move, you'll fall!" But his words would have been lost in the noise of the fair. He pushed through the crowd toward the cathedral. Jonathan was running along the scaffolding, absorbed in some imaginary game, heedless of the danger that he might slip and fall over the edge and tumble 80 feet to his death. Tom quenched the terror rising like bile in his throat. The scaffolding did not rest on the ground, but on heavy timbers inserted into purpose-built holes high up in the walls. These timbers jutted out 6 feet or so. Stout poles were laid across them and roped to them, and then trestles made of flexible saplings and woven reeds were laid on the poles. The scaffolding was normally reached via the spiral stone staircases built into the thicknesses of the walls, but those staircases had been closed off today. So how had Jonathan climbed up? There were no ladders. Tom had seen to that, and Jack had double-checked. The child must have climbed up the stepped end of the unfinished wall. The ends had been built up with wood, so that they no longer provided easy access, but Jonathan could have clambered over the blocks. The child was full of self-confidence, but all the same, he fell over at least once a day. Tom reached the foot of the wall and looked up fearfully. Jonathan was playing happily 80 feet above. Fear gripped Tom's heart with a cold hand. He shouted at the top of his voice, "Jonathan!" The people around him were startled, and looked up to see what he was shouting at. As they spotted the child on the scaffolding, they pointed him out to their friends. A small crowd gathered. Jonathan had not heard. Tom cupped his hands around his mouth and shouted again, "Jonathan! Jonathan!" This time the boy heard. He looked down, saw Tom, and waved. Tom shouted, "Come down!" Jonathan seemed about to obey. Then he looked at the wall along which he would have to walk, and the steep flights of steps he would have to descend, and he changed his mind. "I can't," he called back,
and his high voice floated down to the people on the ground. Tom realized he was going to have to go up and get him. "Just stay where you are until I reach you," he shouted. He pushed the blocks of wood off the lower steps and mounted the wall. It was 4 feet wide at the foot, but it narrowed as it went up. Tom climbed steadily. He was tempted to rush, but he forced himself to be calm. When he glanced up, he saw Jonathan sitting on the edge of the scaffolding, dangling his short legs over the sheer drop. At the very top, the wall was only 2 feet thick. Even so, it was plenty wide enough to walk on, provided you had strong nerves, and Tom did. He made his way along the wall, jumped down onto the scaffolding, and took Jonathan in his arms. He was swamped with relief. "You foolish boy," he said, but his voice was full of love, and Jonathan hugged him. After a moment, Tom looked down again. He saw a sea of upturned faces. 100 or more people were watching. They probably thought it was another show like the bear baiting. Tom said to Jonathan, "All right, let's go down now." He set the boy on the wall and said, "I'll be right behind you, so don't worry." Jonathan was not convinced. "I'm scared," he said. He held out his arms to be picked up, and when Tom hesitated, he burst into tears. "Never mind. I'll carry you," Tom said. He was not very happy about it, but Jonathan was now too upset to be trusted at this height. Tom clambered onto the wall, knelt beside Jonathan, picked him up and stood upright. Jonathan held on tight. Tom stepped forward. Because he had the child in his arms, he could not see the stones immediately beneath his feet. That could not be helped. With his heart in his mouth, he walked gingerly along the wall, placing his feet cautiously. He had no fear for himself, but with the child in his arms he was terrified. At last he came to the beginning of the steps. It was no wider here at first, but somehow it seemed less precipitous, with the steps in front of him. He started down gratefully. With each step he felt calmer. When he reached the level of the gallery and the wall widened to 3 feet, he paused to let his heartbeat slow down. He looked out, past the Priory Close, over Kingsbridge, to the fields beyond, and there he saw something that puzzled him. There was a cloud of dust on the road leading to Kingsbridge, about half a mile away. After a moment he realized that he was looking at a large troop of men on horseback, approaching the town at a smart trot. He peered into the distance, trying to figure out who they were. At first he thought it must be a very wealthy merchant or a group of merchants with a large entourage, but there were too many of them, and somehow they did not look like commercial people. He tried to put his finger on what it was about them that made him think they were something other than merchants. As they came closer, he saw that some of them were riding war horses, most had helmets, and they were armed to the teeth. Suddenly he felt scared. "Jesus Christ, who are those people?" he said aloud.
"Don't say Christ," Jonathan reprimanded him.
Whoever they were, they meant trouble. Tom hurried down the steps. The crowd cheered as he jumped down to the ground. He ignored them. Where were Ellen and the children? He looked all around, but he could not see them. Jonathan tried to wriggle out of his arms. Tom held him tight. As he had his youngest child right here, the first thing to do was to put him somewhere safe. Then he could find the others. He pushed through the crowd to the door that led into the cloisters. It was locked from the inside, to preserve the privacy of the monastery during the fair. Tom banged on it and yelled, "Open up! Open up!" Nothing happened. Tom was not even sure that there was anyone in the cloisters. There was no time to speculate. He stepped back, put Jonathan down, lifted his large, booted right foot, and kicked at the door. The wood around the lock splintered. He kicked it again, harder. The door flew open. Just the other side of it was an elderly monk, looking astonished. Tom lifted Jonathan and put him inside. "Keep him in there," he said to the old monk. "There's going to be trouble." The monk nodded dumbly and took Jonathan's hand. Tom closed the door. Now he had to find the rest of his family in a crowd of 1,000 or more. The near impossibility of the task scared him. He could not see a single familiar face. He climbed onto an empty beer barrel to get a better view. It was midday and the fair was at its height. The crowd moved like a slow river along the aisles between the stalls, and there were eddies around the vendors of food and drink as people queued to buy dinner. Tom raked the crowds, but he could not see any of his family.
he despaired. He looked over the roofs of the houses. The riders were almost at the bridge, and had increased their pace to a gallop. They were men-at-arms, all of them, and they carried firebrands.